A few months ago, it was this spring, I think it was March, I was asked to speak at a meeting, and the theme of the meeting, lots of times there's themes at meetings, and the theme had to do with mountains, various mountains found in the Bible. And so there was not only a mountain, it wasn't a meeting about history lessons, but it was mountains, and then some of the lessons that can be drawn are some of the things that are stories associated with those mountains. The mountain that I was given was the Mount of Olives. And that's something that I really enjoyed preparing some thoughts on. And so I thought I would share some of those with you this morning. It's a little bit of a different lesson because I was asked to speak a little bit about the Mount of Olives. And then the lesson or the thought that we could draw from that or that I was to focus my thoughts on was preparing for death. And obviously the story there is Christ praying on the Mount of Olives. So the first portion of this is just going to be a little bit informational about the Mount of Olives at a high level. And then we're going to talk about some of the lessons that we can draw from some of the stories that we find in the Mount of Olives. So, behind me we have a horribly drawn map of Jerusalem. The square here, this is essentially Jerusalem. Inside Jerusalem there was a number of mounts, but the two of the most prominent ones was the Temple Mount, which was approximately here, and then the Mount of Zion. There's a little bit of dispute because there is another mount here that Zion may have been one of those two, but I believe it's in the southwest corner. So here we have the walls of Jerusalem. We have the Temple Mount and the Mount of Zion, and then right outside the Temple Wall, right outside the Eastern Wall, we have the Kidron Valley, which you know we've probably heard of, and you can see a number of times in the Scriptures. Shortly past the Kidron Valley, then we have the Garden of Gethsemane, and then here we have a hill that has three separate peaks, or not a hill, a mountain. And so the Mount of Olives actually has three peaks. These three peaks in aggregate are what we term as the Mount of Olives. Just below that to the south, and this may be a little harder for some of you to see, but just below that to the south is what we have termed as the Mount of Offense. And so here the Mount of Olives is just along the east side, just past the Garden of Gethsemane, the Kidron Valley, and the city of Jerusalem. On the southeastern slope of the Mount of Olives is where we believe that the town of Bethany was located. So just to give a little bit of layout, and I know it's not aesthetically pleasing, but in my mind, I really like to have some frame of reference with respect to this. So just some dynamics of this, because I've read story after story after story involving some of these places, but I don't always have a great geographical understanding of it. So just as a frame of reference, from the temple to the Garden of Gethsemane is approximately 400 feet. It's really not very far at all. Now, granted, there's a Kidron Valley and there's some elevation changes, and it would be 400 feet as the crows fly. Now, if you were to go there, you'd have to get out to one of the gates and then I'm sure zigzag around, and it would be a little bit harder than it would be for us just to walk 400 feet down the street. But with respect to proximity, the Garden of Gethsemane and the temple was not very far. Also, from the temple to about the top of the Mount of Olives was only about 1,500 feet. So that wasn't that far. With respect to just sheer distance, you could easily see that far, especially if there was any sort of elevation, which the Mount of Olives is about 2,700 feet in elevation from sea level, from the Kidron Valley from the Kidron Valley up to the top of here is about 1,500 feet. So it is about 1,500 feet higher than the area below, and it's also about 1,500 feet from the temple. And so that kind of just gives me a little bit of a frame of reference with respect to the Mount of Olives. It's an incredibly famous mount. You know, we hear about, if you were to list some of the mountains in the Bible, that would undoubtedly be one of the first ones that we would come up with. But I was surprised to find that there's really only 8 separate occasions that the Mount of Olives is spoken about. It's referenced a total of 14 times in our Bibles, but those 14 times are only talking about 8 different instances. And obviously the harmony of the Gospels, the overlapping of some of the Gospel accounts is why there's those 14 are only talking about 8 separate instances. The first instance that we find is in 2 Samuel chapter 15, verses 30 and 32, and that's when David flees from Absalom. Absalom has come in and kind of taken over, and David is fleeing, and he flees Jerusalem across the valley to the Mount of Olives. We also see it in Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 4. And this is an interesting passage. It has to do with prophetic language about a spiritual attack on assault that's coming on Jerusalem. And so even though it's referenced there, it's not really the physical Mount of Olives that's being addressed there. And then the other 5 instances we find in the New Testament. One of them is in John chapter 7, which we'll turn to in a moment. Matthew 21, Mark 11, and Luke 19, we all have the account of the, or all carry the account of the triumphal entry, the last week of Christ's life here on this earth. And so he's coming from the Mount of Olives, and it appears that he's entering from Bethany. So we think that he would have been traveling south and probably would not have gone over the mount, but around it and then up to the temple from this way. So it would have been a natural path to take to get into the temple from there. Mark 13 and Matthew 24 both predict the destruction of Jerusalem, and it has some accounts about the Mount of Olives as well there. Luke 21, there's a reference of Christ spending some time on the Mount of Olives. We'll turn to that passage in a second. And then the Last Supper, Matthew 26, Matthew 14, and Luke 22 shows that they came out of there. And in Acts chapter 1, I know I went through these very quickly, but in Acts chapter 1, Christ's ascension, it says that, and I'll read that. In Acts chapter 1, verse 12, after his ascension, it says, "Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day journey." So it appears that Christ's ascension was on the Mount of Olives, and then they returned into the city walls of Jerusalem, into the upper room, and that's when they chose Matthias to be the replacement for Judas. I was surprised to find that it was only those eight stories that we have speaking about the Mount of Olives, and yet that is all that we have it about. In John chapter 7, verse 53, and John chapter 8, verse 1, it's the very last verse of John chapter 7 and the very first verse of John chapter 1. And this is right off the heels of some of the Pharisees trying to trip Jesus up. This is not uncommon. That seemed to happen with some regularity. But after this dispute and after this kind of this showdown, then it says in verse 53 of John chapter 7, "And everyone went to his own house." So after this kind of thing, they all dispersed. Everyone went to his own house. Well, what's that have to do with the Mount of Olives? Well, if we drop down to chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives." Jesus didn't have a home. We know that. Jesus didn't have a house to return to. And so after this discussion, when everybody scattered, when the dust settled, everybody went home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. We can also turn to Luke chapter 21 and find a similar, some similar information. Talking about Christ, Luke chapter 21, verse 37, it says, "And in the daytime he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and stayed on the mountain called Olivet." And so here we have two examples of him spending his nights. It appears that Jesus spent a number of his evenings and slept here on the Mount of Olives. And it would have been probably on this western side of closest to Jerusalem. And that is a place where there was kind of, I don't know if I want to call it a homeless camp, but there was travelers that were coming in. There was just kind of an area for people to spend a lot of time on. And so it wouldn't have been uncommon to have some people just camping along the slopes. And you know, my curiosity gets the best of me. I'd love to know what that looked like. What kind of bed rolls or lack thereof? I don't know. I doubt they had, I know for certain that they didn't have campsite number 32 like we have when we go, and they probably weren't booking reservations online for the Labor Day holiday or anything like that. But there would have been a few people at least staying out there, and it appears that Jesus spent some of his time doing that as well. Maybe that's not interesting to you. I found it to be a little interesting, and so I thought it might be worth our time to consider at least some of that, just to get a little bit of flavor of what the Mount of Olives is. The second part of this lesson that they asked me to address and that I'd like to share some thoughts with you about is preparing for death. We know that Christ went and he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is right here on the downward slopes, or the early slopes of the Mount of Olives. Preparing for death. I came across a story in which a 19th century French soldier who was mortally wounded on a battlefield, you know, back in the kind of Napoleon times with the that type of warfare. He was mortally wounded on the battlefield, and he looked up to one of his comrades and he said, "I did not mean to die today. I didn't mean to die today. I got up. I'm a soldier. I was going to engage in battle, but today wasn't the day that I intended to die." And yet that was the day that he died. Death does happen, and we all know that. It's not fun, it's not enjoyable to think about, but it is reality. We are going to die. And ignoring that fact, or perhaps running from that fact, only makes our pending death more tragic. As with so many things in life, we can choose to handle something wisely, the situation that we're presented with wisely, or we can choose to handle it foolishly. We can choose to plan for some things, we can choose to put some forethought into it, or we can choose to stick our head in the sands. We can be wise or foolish, it's up to us. When I was thinking about this, my mind kind of went to the wise man and the foolish man. You know, you have a choice. Where do you want to build your house on, the rock or the sand? Or it also went to Joshua when he says in chapter 24, verse 15, I believe, it says, "Choose this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Well, it's a different application, and it's not exactly the same. We could almost make a similar statement saying, choose this day if we're going to be prepared for our death. Because it is coming. In reality, if you step back and think about it, the whole Christian life is a preparation for our death. It sounds funny, perhaps, to prepare your whole life for your life to end, but in reality, that's kind of what it is. This is just a training ground. This is just a temporary thing. It's just a small slice of what is to come. We do, in a sense, spend our whole life in preparation for our life's end. But what is death? Is death an end or is death a beginning? Is anyone sad when a baby leaves a womb? No, we're not sad about that. The only time that we're sad when a baby, we're excited when a baby's born, aren't we? Typically, I'm not a big baby person, but I'm happy for the people involved. We're happy when babies are born, right? We're not sad about that. But when are we sad when a baby's born? Typically, we're sad when, for some reason, that baby is ill-equipped to handle the life that they're about to have. Maybe they're deformed in some capacity. Maybe they're, you know, just they're not right. Something's not right with the child. And that's when we become sad. And if you think about it, I believe that that's the exact same way that God looks at death. Death is only sad if we're not prepared for it. The afterlife is only sad if we're not prepared for it. I think in heaven, death is a very joyful thing. It's another one coming home. And it's only sad when the individuals, when the people, when us aren't ready for that homecoming. Is God sad when somebody dies? Well, only when they're not prepared for eternity. And as I was thinking about this, it's kind of funny how, you know, well, maybe it's not funny, I don't know. But my mind went to Moses and how he spent all that time leading the children around for 40 years and doing the 10 plagues and doing all of that stuff to get the children of Israel out of Egypt. And he did all that, and he put up with all that complaining and all that grumbling, and he did so much work. I mean, talk about never having a day off. That guy had a burden to bear. And then he doesn't get to go in to the promised land. And we know that God, that was kind of his punishment, or not kind of, that was his punishment for taking some credit for himself that he shouldn't have done. But I still have always kind of thought, you know, it seems like Moses may have got the short end of the stick on that. But then as you think about it, God may have done Moses an incredible favor. You know, death is not horrible. He may have just said, you know what, Moses, you put in your time. Once you cross that river, there's going to be a whole lot of people that have to get slaughtered. There's going to be a whole lot of settling. You know what, we're going to let Joshua take care of that. You did good. Why don't you come on home? It's really interesting because I'd always thought of that as when Moses got up onto the mountain and got to look and see the promised land. I thought it was so sad that he didn't ever get to go into it, but, you know. The promised land that Moses went to is a whole lot better than the fields that he was looking at. And that's something that I find some comfort in, and just a difference of perspective that we might look at those things. So with respect to preparing for death, as I've had some overall comments about death, what did Christ do? If we're talking about the Mount of Olives and trying to prepare our lives for death, well, what did Christ do as he was preparing for his death? Well, in John 19:26, I won't turn there, but in John 19:26, that's when he looks down at John and says, "Woman, behold your son, and behold your mother." He did have some physical things to take care of. In one of his last moments, he was concerned about the physical well-being of his mother. And so what lessons can we draw from that? Well, I think there is some responsibility for us to be concerned about the well-being of our friends and our families. And I don't know to what extent to take this, but there's some legal and some financial things that I think is very prudent for us to set in place. If you're married and don't have life insurance, I think that'd be a very good thing for you to consider. We should consider that thing. One of the comforts that I have is that I know if something happens to me that Shelby will be taken care of in that respect. I assume and I hope, and I don't hope, but I know that, I didn't say that right, she'd be really upset if something happened to me. But it's comforting to me to know that that wouldn't be an additional burden to her. It's going to be enough of an emotional burden that she won't have to be faced with a financial burden as well. If our savings and nest eggs aren't enough to support our families, then we ought to look into life insurance. If you have children and you don't have a will, that's something that you should very seriously look into. Even if they're grown children, just things, there can be some bickering or just some misunderstandings or some things. Or even if it's not a legal thing that's drawn up and certified and notified by all the powers to be, just some simple instructions saying, this is what we'd like to have done. This is what I'd like to have done with our assets or with our funeral or with what's going on. Just taking care of these things and putting a little bit of forethought into it beforehand can make our friends and family and loved ones' jobs a lot easier. Because, again, it's going to be so much stressful. There's so much you have to deal with on an emotional level that the more that we can relieve from them on a logistic level would be good. Shelby and I just had a conversation the other day about she's from Brookfield, Missouri, and she lives down here. I'm her only family here. And if something were to happen to her, would she want to be laid to rest here in Kansas City or back in Brookfield? And, you know, we kind of talked about that and had a conclusion. And something I hadn't really thought about, but if something did happen to her and we hadn't had that conversation, I would have stressed about that a little. I would have really wondered what would she have wanted to do. And so just having some very candid thoughts, it's not pleasant, it's not fun, but it can be make our families' lives a little easier. What else did Christ do as he was preparing for his death? Well, besides taking care of some physical responsibilities of his mother or of loved ones, but he also equipped the apostles with some final words. The last week of Christ's life was full of bold teaching for his followers, telling what they needed to know and what they needed to hear. If we turn over to Luke chapter 19, we see the triumphal entry. And so Luke chapter 19, we have the triumphal entry, and in Luke chapter 23, we have the crucifixion. So those are the chapters in between, 20, 21, and 22, is the time between his entering of Jerusalem and his crucifixion, his last week. And he goes through a number of fairly important teachings in that last week. In Luke chapter 20, verse 25, it's the famous passage where he says, render under Caesar what is Caesar's and under God what is God's, talking about the finances and the taxes. In chapter 20, verses 34 through 38, he has some teaching about the resurrection. In verses 46 and 47, he has warnings about hypocrisy and the scribes. In chapter 21, verses 3 and 4, is the two mites, the woman with the two mites. He exalts her generosity. In verses 7 through 28, he gives some information about the end times and the destruction of Jerusalem. So he really just hammered home some things, some final thoughts in this last week that he wanted his followers and his disciples to know. And so if I bring that forward to today, what lesson is that for us? Well, I think it might be good for us to communicate some final thoughts or final words to our loved ones, to our friends and family. I think it's good to write a letter to loved ones that you have, or friends or family, for them to read after it is that you're gone, to give some instructions, to give some encouragement, to give some final warnings, etc. We see in 2 Timothy, that's the last letter that we have that Paul wrote, and it's chocked full of that kind of stuff, or 2 Peter, too, just chocked full of reminding, encouraging those people that are going to be left behind because they had concern for it, and I think it could be appropriate for us to do the same thing. A number of years ago, it'd be close to 20 years now, I read a book on the Korean War, and I don't remember a lot of it. I don't know much about the Korean War. It seems to be kind of the forgotten war in American history. But it was written by a man who served in the Korean War, and one of the things that I took from that book is that it was just brutally cold, horribly cold. And there was a story, there was a soldier in there who had suffered a wound in which his lower jaw had been removed or blown away. Blown off. And the only thing that was keeping him alive was the fact that the bitter cold had frozen and clotted the blood. And so I know this might be a little morbid, but so this soldier was here in the medical tent and he saw this, and the doctor told that young man who lost the part of his chin, he said, in the afternoon when it warms up, your face is going to thaw and there's nothing I can do. Like, I can't stop it. I can't save you. You know, when the temperature reaches a certain level, you're going to die. And the author of the book said the last time that he ever saw that soldier was sitting on a wood stump with a piece of paper and a pencil. And I don't know what he wrote, you know, but I hope that whatever he wrote got to who he was writing it to. You know, and it's just one of those things that, you know, final thoughts, final words, last things that we'd like to communicate, I think can be important. And I think that they ought to be something that we consider seriously. I may have said this before. In fact, I'm sure I have. But there's a dear brother of mine at Smart Road that is there and has been there for the past 10 years because his father wrote such a letter. His father passed away. This man had been raised in the church, had fallen away. His father passed away and wrote each of his boys a letter. And when this man wrote the letter from his father, it got him back in gear, and he's been back at Smart Road as a member for the past 10 years. These things can have effects on people, and we ought to consider doing those kinds of things. So that's maybe some preparation on the physical level. How do we prepare spiritually for our death? Well, I don't know exactly, but I think there's some things for us to consider. And the first thing is that of prayer. If we find ourselves in a situation where, death happens to everyone. It happens to us all, but it's in different forms. You know, some people have a condition where they know that it's likely, and some people, an accident, a freak accident where they're taken very suddenly. But if you find yourself in a situation that you're facing that, coming to lean on God for strength, I think, would be an incredible benefit. It's a stressful enough situation. There's unknown, and it can be scary, but the Lord is there. The Lord wants us to be comforted. The Lord is, as 2 Corinthians tells us, the God of comfort. He doesn't want us to be scared. He doesn't want us to fear these things. It's human nature for us to fear those things, but he wants us to seek comfort from him in those types of situations. Generally speaking, and this is a broad topic, but also in preparing for our death, we ought to just live a godly life. Take the time and the effort to live a godly life. Repair relationships that perhaps need to be repaired. Ephesians 4:26 tells us not to let the sun go down on our wrath. Repair relationships, because we might not always have tomorrow. We might not have time to do those things later. I'll get to it later. There's a number of things that we say that we'll get to later, but perhaps we won't. And aligning our wills with God. Luke 22 and verse 42 talks about Christ saying, "Not my will, but thine will." If we can repair relationships horizontally with our brethren and with our mankind, and we can repair our relationship vertically and align our will with God, "Not my will, but thine." As I mentioned in these chapters in Luke, is Christ's last week. If we look at Luke chapter 21, verse 34, Christ specifically gives some instruction about watching for his return, or watching for the last times. And in verse 34, he says, "But take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly." So he's telling them, you know, be careful that you don't get caught unawares. But what are the three things that he says specifically? He says that your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this world. I'm not tooting my own horn in any capacity, but when I read that, I don't feel like I'm overly tempted by drunkenness or carousing. That's just not something that appeals to me. But the third thing is the cares of this world. That's something that for me is very easy to get caught up in. And yet he says, don't allow that to happen, because the cares of this world can prevent us from being prepared for the day. Because of the cares of this world, that day, the day of judgment or the day of our end, may come on you unexpectedly. Always pushing things down later and later and later for the cares of this world. What do we spend our time doing, and how much of our time is with repairing relationships or deepening our relationships with Christians and with the Lord? There's a big difference between those who live for this life and those who live for the next. And as Christians, we ought to be living our lives for the next. In 1 Corinthians 9:24, Paul talks about running in a way that we may obtain the prize. That is the goal. The end prize is to please our Father and to have a good relationship with both him and his Son. And so lastly, as I start to draw my thoughts to a close, really, if we're trying to prepare for death, if we want to prepare for the afterlife, the most salient and most important thing that we can do is have a healthy relationship with Jesus Christ. Romans chapter 6, I think, outlines this beautifully, in that we are to be buried and raised with Christ, and that we are to be dead to sin when we put on the white robes that we get from entering into the waters of baptism. You know, there's a lot of types and shadows in the Bible, and it's interesting. It's interesting that Christ is called the Good Shepherd, and it's interesting that David was a shepherd when he was chosen to lead God's people, because I think in a lot of ways, as people, we are sheep. I think God looks down at us the way we look at sheep. God may look down at us and see very similar things. It's all kind of types and shadows for us to understand what it is. And so in some sense, Christ is just the loving, gentlest, most comforting shepherd that there can be. And he even tells us that his own know his voice in the book of John. And yet at the same time, he's also the being that we see that created everything. He was there in Genesis 1. It says in Colossians that everything was created by him and through him and for him. He is the creator. He's the force that holds this all together, holds this universe together. I don't understand all of that, but I know that it's an incredibly powerful being that created me, that gave me life, and that he also loves me to the point that he died. Like, what more could somebody do? He gave me existence, and then, knowing that I wasn't going to live as I should, he died for me. So not only did he give me life, but he knew that I was going to mess that life up. So he died so that I could have redemption and an opportunity at a second life. I find that fascinating, and I find it humbling. I find it inspiring. And when I think in those terms, it inspires me and it makes me want to be a better person. As I draw my thoughts to a close, Leonardo da Vinci says, and he's, you know, a genius in so many categories and brilliant on so many fronts, not only as an artist, but he's been credited on his deathbed as saying, "I have offended God and mankind because my work did not reach the quality that it should have. I've offended God and mankind because my life did not reach the quality that it should have." Well, if we can change that a little bit and just say, "I've offended God because my life didn't reflect the service that it should have," I think that can be a humbling thing. If there's anything that we can do for anybody, please come forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.